Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. This is Airtime, extended conversations with interesting people. This week, a look at the mark that Hunter S. Thompson left on journalism, and journalist Jose Antonio Vargas's perspective as an undocumented reporter. Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Public Radio's new show, Airtime. Stay tuned. Timothy Deneve's new book, Freak Kingdom, documents Hunter S. Thompson's reporting in the 1960s and 70s. As Thompson covered politics in a fraught America, he diverged from journalistic standards and began his own gonzo style of reporting. It was a time in America's history that is feeling quite familiar these days. Why Hunter S. Thompson? Why this topic?
I'd always been interested in Hunter S. Thompson's journalistic style, the way that he was able to work within the journalism world as a standard journalist for a long time. And then once he learned the rules of the trade, so to speak, he broke them in a very artistic and engaging manner. And I read his work in high school and college. And when I was in my 20s, I was living in Honolulu. And I'll never forget reading on my very small lanai of the very small apartment we were renting near Diamond Head an essay called Strange Rumblings in Aztlan, which is from The Great Shark Hunt, and it's about the murder of Ruben Salazar, a journalist in Los Angeles, and Thompson's investigation of it. And, you know, since then I've been pretty much a full-blown devotee. And I think that coming from a more nonfiction background, that his use of hybridity and different forms and collage and found material is very engaging and is much more hip formally now, even than it was back then. And so it's nice to see his work in a new formal light, as well as a new, as we've seen, political light.
Where does the book open up? How do we get introduced to Hunter S. Thompson?
So the book begins when Hunter Thompson was living in Woody Creek. This was in 1963 on Thursday, November 22nd, and he gets a knock at the door by his neighbor, Wayne Wagner, who's from the Wagners are from some of the research I've seen, they're from an old Aspen family. So he gets a knock on the door, he opens it, and he's been told then at that moment that John F. Kennedy has been assassinated. And he for a moment feels like crying, he swears, and his first impulse after all of that, after the shock, is to go down into Woody Creek in Aspen and to gather people's reactions and to gather what people are saying about it, because through that journalistic lens, he could have a little bit more distance. So that night, he stayed up all night until the next day, wrote letters to his friends about how he felt and how scared he was for America now that power was being transferred. And now that the American head of government had been killed by the threat that had been demonized for the last 10 years as a means for more extreme politicians to take over, the communist threat. And so he was suddenly terrified that Barry Goldwater would be the front runner for the presidential election the next year. And already Goldwater had, from the research I've done, already Goldwater had advocated extreme positions like the use of nuclear weapons to deforest Vietnam or to attack the Soviets in a first strike capability. And he was worried for American democracy and what would happen when we found ourselves on such a in such an extreme position.
You visited Aspen and Woody Creek and the Roaring Fork Valley as part of your research. Did it teach you something? Was it important to come here?
Oh, it was incredibly important. It was important on a research level. I was able to talk to Jane Click from the Aspen Historical Society, and she was incredibly helpful and beneficial, and her perspective on the town and how it's changed from when she came here around when the book was starting to, or in the 70s, to what it's like now, I found to be insightful, because I'm only seeing the city as it is in its current moment. And then also to go to these historic places like the Jerome Hotel, where I set scenes, to go to the Red Onion, and to drive up and down the valley. Of course, I didn't go to Owl Farm, but I was able to go and, you know, drive around downtown Woody Creek and drive around the road right outside of that, where I suddenly realized that when I was driving on that road, I got a sense of deja vu. I wasn't sure what was going on. And I remembered that when Thompson ran for sheriff in 1970, a television crew had come in and they'd filmed him riding on his motorcycle on that road, and you could see in the background the same hillside that I was seeing right then at that time. And that was a fascinating experience to have. So then I could orient the whole valley around that memory and moment. And so, I mean, there's scenes set in West Aspen here, there's scenes set at the hospital, and I needed to go to those places. And even though I understand they're very different than they once were, at least to know where they stand inside this kind of bowl, and then how the valley moves down out towards Basalt and Glenwood was, for me, necessary, especially when it comes to writing nonfiction.
Amongst all the writing and researching that he's doing at this time, he's also doing a lot of drugs. You know, that's the character that's been reimagined or shown in contemporary culture, is the Hunter S. Thompson who's on drugs. How much did that play into this part of his life?
When he was younger, the main drug Thompson consumed was alcohol, and regularly. And from, you know, his teenage years, Juan Thompson's book, Stories I Tell Myself, about a memoir about his father, delves into and really honestly and beautifully addresses Thompson's lifelong alcoholism and the toll that it took. When he was in his mid-20s, he would take dexedrine, which is a drug that's very similar to Adderall. It was before it had been made a Schedule II drug in the 70s, so it was more accessible. And, you know, he found that it allowed him to recover if he had stayed up all night drinking and kind of move through that hangover and do the reporting or work that he needed, and also to stay up all night and to do work in bursts to finish his projects with that extra effort. He was using it as a performance sustainer. I mean, drugs never create the work that we want. They never just from thin air give us a path to it. But what they can do, in Thompson's sense, I think, is give him the opportunity to keep writing on a subject that he's now found himself engaged in. And so at the end of Hell's Angels, when he was finishing up his manuscript and it was due to Random House, this was in 1966, I think, he began to worry that he wasn't going to meet his deadline. And so he drove out of San Francisco, where he was living with his family. He went down to Monterey, which is on the coast, and found an indistinct motel that had a McDonald's hamburgers next to it. And for the next 3 days, he stayed up completely straight, put all his notes together, finished the draft he needed, ate only hamburgers, left to get those, and came back and sent it in. And it's not as romantic as it sounds. It's scary and terrifying. And eventually, there's only so many times you can do that before it takes its toll. But there were moments that, when it came to perhaps sustaining himself at somewhere like a national convention where you have to be up for so long, or it came to the extra focus or effort he needed, that may have been helpful at the time, something like dexedrine. In the end, you know, what we know about psychotropic drugs, I think, if we look back on the 20th century, is that whenever anything is given, something is also lost. Mm. It's always a zero-sum equation. And if you get perhaps a short-term burst of energy, you're going to have to pay for that later. Thompson wrote beautifully about that in his letters and about how worn out he was in the 1970s. And he talks about chemical speed as basically what he thinks trading time now for time later. And so you're using something up that you won't get back now.
Did you speak with any of his editors or with anyone from Rolling Stone? What was it like to be on the other end, like still going after journalistic integrity and principles, but while trying to put Hunter S. Thompson in check?
Well, it became harder because the deadlines were so difficult at the end in 1972. But I was able to speak extensively with one of his earlier editors, Margaret Harrell. She was a few years younger than him, and when he was writing Hell's Angels. And she said it was hard to stay on his schedule, which was a nocturnal schedule. It was hard to deal with the sort of personal bluster that Thompson might put out to defend his sentences. But she realized immediately that bluster was genuine. I mean, it wasn't bluster, that it was a genuine care for the shape and form of his work that he's spending his every moment trying to create. And so she talked about how she was able very quickly to see past any emotion that might be attached to decisions that had to be made in terms of editing and in terms of what the manuscript would be. And, you know, she was able to shepherd that manuscript through it. It needed a lot of edits and needed a lot of legal checking because the Hell's Angels were terrifying to America. So the legal department at Random House, they didn't even want the word Pepsi to be included in it because they were worried Pepsi would get all mad that, oh my God, they're associated with the Hells Angels. So she had to explain that to him and sort of be the buffer. I think one of the hardest, most, I think one of the areas of conflict that Thompson dealt with the most with editors wasn't just the deadlines, but it was money. Mm. And it was constantly fighting over how much money he should be getting and how much he was worth because his effort was amazing. And even with Margaret Harrell, you know, he kind of went through his editor, her, and Jim Silberman, his other editor, to try to get more money from Random House because he had signed a contract that really didn't protect him if the book would, if the book ended up doing amazingly, which okay. it did. It sold 500,000 copies in its first year. I mean, it was a bestseller. And he should have had incentives in his contract that after 10,000 copies are sold, you'll now get this much. And they weren't there, and it drove him crazy. Mm-hmm. And they worked it out, but even then, from the very beginning, he was, you know, deeply concerned with the value that his work should be receiving. And I think that's something that journalists are facing without a doubt today, is the value that your effort for holding these people in power accountable should be receiving.
You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. I'm speaking with author Tim DeNevy about his book, Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's manic 10-year crusade against American fascism. As he covered the 1972 election, Thompson found he was covering a candidate that worked hard to control the media cycle to his own favor, something journalists today are still working against. What do you think about journalists and journalism covering the Trump administration?
You know, one thing Hunter Thompson fantastically illuminated was the way in which Richard Nixon manipulated the press corps to be able to get a certain version of Nixon to the American public, the version Nixon wanted, a version that Nixon ended up using to win by more than 20 points the presidency in 1972. And Nixon did this by limiting access, by knowing that reporters had certain deadlines and giving them only a little bit of information, by making them watch his speeches on closed circuit broadcasts, by playing favorites and playing them against each other. And Thompson actually dramatized what Nixon was doing in his long form work for Rolling Stone. He had the chance to do it, but because he had more space than many of these journalists, but that's a very, very hard thing to do. It's hard enough, one, to write the news story, the information, which Thompson was doing, he was on the beat, but in addition to write about the way that that information is being manipulated and being set up, it takes an enormous amount of effort. And I think it was a gift to us that we have that. And today, with the current news cycle, it's very difficult. Everybody appears to be losing context, and that's something that benefits Donald Trump and benefits his deeply, deeply unjust administration. And the less context we have, the more that Trump can, with each new crisis, make us forget or overreact to his latest outrageous event, when there are, in a broader sense, serious, serious changes that are happening right now in terms of civil liberties, in terms of the way we approach and understand the American government, and in terms of violence and how the future is going to be.
So what is the role of a journalist? When do they start not just listing events in chronological order and start putting in this bigger context or even some opinion?
I mean, it's the goal of the journalist is to expose how the people in the most power are trying to shield the public from knowing enough to diminish that power. It's to expose the corruption that power almost always brings with it, and it's to rigorously and tirelessly use the tools available to them, whatever they might be, to, in their current moment, best attack and address the threats to the people who don't have a voice and the people that aren't running everything around us.
Did he change journalism and our understanding of journalism, or was he that one case where we see it on the timeline and then we go back to that impartiality, that kind of more banal way of looking at reporting?
I think he was one of those great voices of the new journalism movement. We have Tom Wolfe, who's a little more staid. We have Joan Didion, who's absolutely fantastic, the best essayist of the 20th century, who is writing collage pieces like The White Album, which are about the 1960s, in the same way Thompson was writing about the 1960s. And so considering that, what I find fascinating is the way that today, 50 years later, you'll see someone like Tucker Carlson claiming to be the heir of Hunter S. Thompson or claiming to be a huge fan of Hunter S. Thompson. And that to me is terrifying, because the way that the right can use the subjectivity Thompson wants to use to indict people with the most power and then defend the people with the most power is a sobering reminder of the frailty of technique, that it can be adopted and used by any side. And it often is related to it. It often is most effective when observed and understood in tandem with its moment in time. And Thompson's subjectivity and emphasis on it in the 70s was especially effective with Nixon, who was hiding basically everything that Donald Trump ran on and markets himself on. And so to attack Nixon needed a different approach than I think to attack Donald Trump. But beyond approach and technique, what was amazing about Thompson was, again, the perspective. So the perspective would still be there today of this is an unjust and incredible threat to our American democracy, this president. And I would be interesting to see what techniques, if he were a young writer, he'd pull out of his bag to use to go after this president specifically.
When this was all tied up, were you pretty sure of what your opinion and relationship with Hunter S. Thompson is? Like, is that set in your mind?
That's a really good question. I'd been working on this book for a long time, but it was after the 2016 election that I just put everything down and could see what I wanted to do and what I wanted to write. And, you know, that being said, I focused for this book on that 10-year period of 64 to 74. And my opinion on Thompson in that period is fairly set. I would hope, you know, I think when we write about subjects, we inherently distance ourselves from them. Vladimir Nabokov talks about how when anything would appear in his fiction from his real life, he could never then write about it in nonfiction or even talk about it in stories because it had been, in a sense, used up. James Salter talks about writing about cities and how you use that up, and it's hard to write about them again because you've done that once, you know, and the emotion that you felt has been expressed. And so, I mean, I think what is changing now and continues to is my view of 2018 America and what more I can learn from Thompson's perspective in terms of applying it to understanding our incredibly unstable present.
Tim, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That was author Tim DeNevi speaking about his book Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's manic 10-year crusade against American fascism. You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio. Stay with us. Jose Antonio Vargas is a journalist and author. He's also an undocumented immigrant. His book, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen, tells his story of learning to live in the U.S. without status. He was in Aspen this summer at the Aspen Ideas Festival and joined reporter Wyatt Orm in the studio.
On the cover, citizen is underlined.
Yes.
Notes of an Undocumented Citizen.
Yes.
Can you explain that to me?
My goal in the book is to really complicate this idea that this is about legal versus illegal, documented or undocumented. For me, the way we talk about this issue and the way President Trump talks about this issue, the way he campaigned on the issue, the way he won on the issue, the way that he's governing on the issue, is from this very simplistic binary that doesn't reflect the realities of people's lives.
Tell me just like your story, bullet points. When
bullet
you first came to the United States when you were 12, is that right?
Born in the Philippines. Came here when I was 12. My mom, I woke up one morning and my suitcase was packed and my mom said I was going to America. And when I got to America in California, where Silicon Valley is, I lived with my grandparents, my mother's parents, who were both naturalized U.S. citizens. Then when I was 16, 4 years later, I found out that I could get a driver's license if you're 16. And my friends were tired of driving me around, so they're like, hey, get a license. So I did. I went to the DMV, took my school ID, Mountain View High School ID, and took my green card that my grandfather, you know, always putting in like a manila envelope folder in his bedroom, took that with me, and then went to the DMV. And the woman at the DMV told me that the green card was fake. My grandfather confirmed it. That was when kind of the house of lies started crumbling, right? Like I was actually brought here by a smuggler. I didn't know he was a smuggler. I thought he was my uncle. That's how he was introduced to me. My grandfather had paid this man $4,500, which is a lot of money for, you know, my grandfather was a security guard making $7 an hour. And then my grandfather said that the only way to make me stay so I could stay was marry a U.S. citizen woman and poof. And then that's when I came out to my grandfather and said, no, I'm actually gay. Mm-hmm. And one lie was enough.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. My salvation, though, like the salvation comes, and I describe this in the book, when my English teacher, Mrs. Dewar, said I asked too many annoying questions and I should do this thing called journalism. Didn't know what journalism was. Mm-hmm. You know, I come from a family of, you know, food service workers and security guards and farmers. Mm-hmm. We don't have any writers in the family.
Right.
But when I found out that when you write a news story in the newspaper, you get a thing called a byline, like by Jose Antonio Vargas. Uh-huh. So I very naively thought to myself, if I can't be here because I don't have the right papers, well, at least my name could be in the newspaper.
Was kind of mastering the language important to you as far as kind of belonging here or kind of developing a sense of belonging here?
Control.
So can you tell me about that? Yeah, I mean, is that something that like maybe you weren't conscious of?
When I was younger, I wasn't. I mean, literally, and again, it sounds very naive, but as a 17-year-old, there was no Google. I didn't talk to anyone about it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because I didn't know what to say about it. Like, we didn't really have language around it. Illegal aliens, the wall, the border, Mexico. That was it, mm-hmm. right? Like, where does a Filipino fit in that frame?
Right.
So I certainly, the only reason I became a journalist was literally so I could write in English, interview people, right? Mm-hmm. Interview Americans. And so that my name could be on a piece of paper. It wasn't until I was like, a political reporter for the Washington Post, you know, in my late 20s, right? That I started realizing that it was my own way of kind of rebellion, that writing was my way of having control. Mm-hmm. Writing was my way of insisting on my own narrative.
So in your prologue, one thing that you say is that immigration, the whole U.S. immigration system is kind of woefully misunderstood. And I just want you, I want you to just give listeners a few examples of ways in which they might misunderstand it or just things that like someone who doesn't have to navigate the system might not know if they don't really interact with it much.
And again, this perspective is coming from an undocumented a journalist who happens to be undocumented. One example of this is how most journalists have no idea what this issue is. Right?
Right.
And if journalists themselves don't know what it is, how the hell are they supposed to explain it to people, right?
Right.
Like the question that I probably get from most journalists who talk to me about this is like, so I don't understand why you can't just make yourself legal. As if all I have to do is like walk to the city hall in Aspen, fill out a form, and poof, I'm an American stealing your welfare, right? As much as we talk about this issue, people have very little understanding of the process, politics, right? From, you know, Reagan to the first Bush presidency to Bill Clinton, right? Like, you know, when people now are blaming Republicans for everything that's happening on immigration, it's very, very important to remind them that both President Clinton and President Obama are also responsible for the mess that we have right in front of us. This has been a bipartisan mess. Mm-hmm. Both parties, to a greater extent, Republicans, have taken full advantage of people's lack of knowledge of what this issue really is about. As much as we talk about immigration in this country from mostly a politics and a policy perspective, the thing that we rarely really talk about is why people come. Why are they here? Why do we come here? Whenever I divulged this situation to someone, I felt like I was burdening them with something.
What does that feel like? I mean, what does that feel like to be, you know, you're at the Washington Post and you are sort of, you have this thing sort of hanging over you that your time in this country is completely and totally undetermined.
Undetermined. And, you know, that those 5 years working for the Washington Post in Washington, D.C., post 9/11, during the era when, you know, the war on terror and migration got completely married to this issue of terrorism. Right. Those are probably the hardest years. This tension between being visible and being invisible at the same time. Right. Like I you know, the Washington Post then and now is a very competitive place. Right. Like I must have been such an enigma to my colleagues and my, because I was always just in a rush. Right. I was always like the next story, the next story, the next story. Like my life was about writing these stories that made me feel like I was contributing something, that my life here was worthy of something.
You know, you mentioned in your talk with David Brooks that there was that you were at a rally maybe with other undocumented people, and there was a guy who
one of the leaders
essentially said to you, "No, you're sort of not actually one of us because you're too successful." Did that offend you? But was it confusing? I mean,
it was hurtful.
It was hurtful. So explain why, please.
It was hurtful because I thought I had spent, you know, all of my 20s trying to pass and fit in an environment where I wasn't supposed to be, you know, like working at the Washington Post, being a political reporter, you know, people would look at me like, how the hell did that kid get to be, you know, like that, right? So then I come out as undocumented and I thought I'm with my people. And then he goes, you're not really one of us. So then I was like, well, where do I go, right? Like, am I taking too much space? Right? Like, is it a problem that I talk the way that I do? Like, does that make me less authentic? You know, look, I can deal with all the trolls who watch Fox News, who like send me death threats and want me to be deported. I can deal with that. That's not a problem for me.
Yeah.
The hardest thing has been dealing with other undocumented people who I feel until writing this book, actually, I didn't realize how much guilt I had carried, you know, like the guilt of passing.
That was writer Jose Antonio Vargas speaking about his book, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. You've been listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio, the conversations, questions, and issues that deserve more time. This week you heard from reporter Wyatt Orem and myself, Allison Bektesh. You can podcast or stream this show online, aspenpublicradio.org. Airtime is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.